Accession number 8736, rule number 47.
Lord Harding, tape 47. Did you get much opinion from the Turkish press? How the Turks...
No, not a lot, no. They had a correspondent there all the time. No, I don't think so. I mean, the Turkish press were probably critical if they... in their comments that we weren't being tough enough with the UKA. That's our main line, I think.
You mentioned censorship of the press as well, that you had the powers for censorship.
Yeah.
And I think you said earlier on in our interview that regarding the Times of Cyprus, it was necessary at one time to suppress it.
Yes.
Well, what occasion was that?
I can't remember.
But you really felt...
They were very... their line was almost, so to speak, full support for the campaign for innocence and no attempt to... to put an end to the violence. No writing or publicity condemning violence. I had the same argument with the then Archbishop of Canterbury, of course, Fisher. And on one occasion, when I was at home, I was very anxious to get him, and in this I was supported by Lennox Boyd, to get him in his capacity as head of the Anglican Church to persuade Makarios to give up the use of violence for political ends. But he declined to do so. And at one occasion I had a meeting with him and Lennox Boyd, and we both worked on him to try and get him to do this. We thought it would be effective and helpful if Fisher used his influence as the head of the Anglican Church with the head of the Greek Orthodox Church in Cyprus, Makarios. But he declined to do so, and his argument was, and I think it's understandable, his argument was that the relationships between the Church of England and the Greek Orthodox Church were at a very good and high level. They weren't in communion, but they were. There were the relationships were very good. And that was a continuing factor and a very important one. He agreed that Makarios was, I don't know whether he used the same word as I used, an evil man or a bad man, I think he probably said, but that that would pass. Whereas the relationship between the Church of England and the Greek Orthodox Church was a continuing thing. And therefore, he was not prepared to do anything which would prejudice the continuing good relationships between the Church of England and the Greek Orthodox Church. And that was his position. I told him I thought he was sacrificing principle to expediency, but he didn't like that much. But that is what I still think. And actually, on another occasion, he preached a sermon here in our little church when he retired and came to live in Trent. He used to come over and take the services occasionally here, and really acted as a sort of curate to our rector. And on one occasion he was preaching a sermon about martyrs and what they'd achieved and martyrdom and what it signified, and he was deploying his argument in a very interesting way, and I was listening quite attentively, when suddenly he looked over the edge of the pulpit, and my wife and I were sitting just below the pulpit, looked straight down at me and said, I don't know whether Lord Harding would regard Archbishop Makarios as a martyr or not. In the middle of his sermon, I was about to jump to my feet, and then I thought, well, perhaps it would be inappropriate to take him on in the church, so I hustled my wife out, and I think one couple escaped in front of us, but then I had a real up and down over them in the porch, in the course of which I said, Martha, my foot, hypocrite was the name for that man. He said, oh, no, no, John, he thought he was doing the will of God. I said, now come off it, Archbishop. And he said, yes, and he was one of the five men who cried in my study. I knew Fisher had a meeting with him, and he invited him to the Lambeth Conference one year after I'd left Cyprus. And I said, who were the other four? And he said, well, I won't tell you, because I'm going to write a book about it. And that was the end of that discussion. I also tried to enlist Eisenhower's interest and support in putting pressure on the Greeks to give up the use of violence. But I was persuaded by Monty. I wrote to him about it and was persuaded by him. He said, well, I wrote back and said, well, he would be visiting Ike quite soon, and he would do it. He would put the case to him, which was a mistake on my part, and of course it came to nothing. I ought to have written to Ike myself direct, but I don't think the Americans would have intervened at that stage in the way that would have been helpful in dealing with the Oka and putting it into their operations. But that was another thing which I contemplated and actually did start moving towards, but it wouldn't have, I don't think it would have been effective if it had been successful in my initiative to Eisenhower.
Were there any other foci of support for you and what you were doing in Cyprus?
No, I think those are the main ones that I tried to enlist bring about pressure on the Greek government and Athens and also on Makarios individually to give up the use of violence in pursuit of innocence. That wasn't successful.
You did mention earlier on that there was no group in the UK, for instance, a sort of pressure public group for what you were doing in Cyprus. There was plenty of criticism. Did you lack that? You know, was that something you could have done with, do you think?
Well, it always makes it easier, doesn't it, if you've got the... I had the absolute unstinted support of British the government.
Yes, you did
London.
Make that quite clear.
I want to make that, emphasize that. There was no question about that, whatever. But the media and the press, I think, were critical. As indeed they naturally would have been, I think, about what they thought was a colonialism. Was described as colonialism, and a rather perhaps, not ruthless, but a firm campaign against the terrorist organization. It would have been, the Labour Party in particular, were very critical of both of the government more than of me personally. They thought I was just carrying out orders. But I remember having a meeting with Gaitskell and Bevan and Jim Griffiths, who was then when they were in opposition, and trying to explain my policies and plans to them and justify them. I don't know to what extent I carried any conviction with them, but I found Aaron Bevin more human than Gaitskell, for example, but that's the personal view, and I don't know. But their general line was in favour of the application of self-determination to Cyprus, which would inevitably have led to a majority vote in favour of innocence. And that was not compatible with the then British government's views and my own views about the strategic, importance of Cyprus and of the way to deal with a terrorist organization. So that was that.
Could I now ask you, you've mentioned the various measures you took, you know, under your state of emergency against EOCA. Could I now ask you about the inducements that you offered? Did you, for instance, offer rewards for information?
Yes, we offered rewards. We offered sort of freedom for trial for people who gave up for what frankly would have been deserters from the EOCA. Amnesties and that sort of thing. I never declared a general amnesty. We called upon them to hand in their arms, in which case they wouldn't be arrested and charged if they did so. Those sort of things.
Did you meet with any success?
No, not to any appreciable extent. Not in any way significant at all, no. I think the ruthless system of command adopted by Grievous prevented them. I mean, they were more afraid of him than they were of me, put it bluntly.
Did you have many informers, though, towards the end of your stay, 57?
I wouldn't know any of the numbers. I wouldn't know about that, but there certainly were informers, yes, of course. Yes, there were informers. And actually, we did... yes, we made use of informers.
Was there any policy on protecting informers, knowing that
you've got to do that. That's a part of the... I mean, if you use informers and if you invite informers to work with you, well, then you've got to ensure their personal protection. That's something that had to be done. Sometimes it wasn't successful, I suppose, but by and large, I think it was.
Could I ask you now a little more about the legal procedures, the civil legal system in Cyprus? Am I right in thinking they had no history of trial by jury on the island?
I don't think so. No, certainly we are, as far as trying of offenders against security regulations, the trials were by judges, but the judges were British judges.
Did they live on the island?
Oh, yes. Yes, and Mr. Justice Shaw... was the Chief Justice. I think he came out from the UK, took over from the Chief Justice, and we had a British Attorney General, a chap called James Henry. But the law courts were conducted in the orthodox way. And as I told you, in the question of Nicholas Sampson, the judge, I don't know whether it was Shaw, I think it was, ruled that the confession, he wasn't satisfied that the confession was entirely voluntary. That implies that the confession was made under pressure. What form that pressure took, I don't know. But I'm certain it didn't include torture.
How about the security of judges? Did they have to be given a lot of protection?
Yes, they were. Shaw was threatened, and I think, yes, they did. They had to be given personal protection by the police. Yes, I think there was.
An assassination attempt on Shaw, yes.
Yes, I think so. Well, those are things that happened in any campaign against terrorists. I mean, one of their tactics is, their supporters, their political supporters, both there and elsewhere, in Athens in particular, was to denigrate and to claim that the processes of justice were not properly conducted, that there was partisanship and injustice was thereby created. I think those were all part of the tactics of a terrorist organization and those who support it. And no doubt, I mean, the Greek government was consistently in support of the campaign for instance.
Could I ask you now a little more about the army operations in the countryside? I think you said early on during your time in Cyprus you had a tour of the island. Is that right? To assess what the situation was. What was the terrain like for guerrilla fighting? Did it favour
You know the geography of Cyprus. I mean, there's the coastline, there's the coastal plains, there's the Messeri plain in the centre of the island, which was mainly occupied by Turks, and then there are the Toros Mountains, which are ideal for terrorist activities. And it was in the Toros Mountains that the mountain gangs made their bases and from which they emerged to carry out attacks on police stations and service installations and so on. Oh no, it's an ideal guerrilla base area, the Toros Mountains, and all along the north coast, mountain range along the coast, north coast too, is ideal for terrorist operations. Although the terrain undoubtedly favoured terrorist guerrilla operations, and Grievous was very highly skilled in the use of the terrain and changed his subordinates, his individual leaders accordingly. And they had the advantage of knowing the country well and making use of it. And British troops coming mainly from urban areas take time to get to know how to use the terrain for anti-terrorist operations. And the same applies to police. So the balance of advantages, terrain-wise, was in favour of the terrorists.
Did you ever participate yourself in any of the operations?
No.
Obviously, it was out of your control.
That wasn't it. I don't consider that part and parcel of a governor, commander-in-chief's duties. The culmination of one operation, which led to the capture of a leading a gang commander, but the fact that I was there then was what I call accidental, or whatever you like to say, incidental, because it just happened that way. But I wouldn't normally have been involved in the detailed conduct of anti-terrorist operations.
Did you have any idea as to the effectiveness of Grievous's intelligence organization? Did he normally have good information?
Oh, he had excellent information. He had plenty of informers. He had plenty of people who would provide him with information, either, as I say, from sympathy or from fear or intimidation. Oh, no, I don't think he was in any way handicapped in his operations by the lack of information. They knew a good deal about my movements and where I went, and so on. And they were able to suborn the domestic staff at Government House to the extent of one of them putting the bomb in my bed, and other things. No, the security of information in an area, in a country where the large percentage of the population are in favour of the, or are prepared to support or shelter the terrorists, is they don't have any problems much about the information or intelligence.
Could you now tell me, Lord Harding, about the finding of the Grievous Diaries? How did this come about?
Well, I don't know. I don't remember much about the detail, but they were found stored away in some urns or something, in a house or a farm which was being searched by a patrol of the House of Cavalry. And that's all I know, that they were found there, and their authenticity was challenged, and but was verified and confirmed by my staff, by handwriting experts and things like that. I don't think there's any doubt about their authenticity, but that's how they were found. I don't know why this particular patrol was searching this farm or farmhouse when they came across them.
That must have been quite a scoop for you to have these.
Well, it was a good thing to have confirmation of what by that time we had firmly concluded, and that was that Makarios was fully involved in the or in the preparations for the opening of a militant campaign in favour of Onassis and in the conduct of the operations. That confirmed what by that time we had come to conclude from what we might call circumstantial evidence.
How about revelations about Grievous and the way his mind worked? Were they useful in that respect?
It's always useful to know something about the opposing commander. Yes, of course. We knew a good deal about his back history, of course, from other sources, about his operations in the Greek Civil War when he was leading a right-wing guerrilla group, and one had a fair assessment of his character from various reports that came around. And it all confirmed that he was not only a very skillful guerrilla leader, which we'd learnt from practical experience, but also an extremely ruthless one, and one who exercised an absolutely total authority over his subordinates. And that, of course, was made the operations easier to conduct and more successful. I mean, there was no unlike a standing army as conductor of operations. I mean, his orders were issued individually to his various group commanders, whether they were in gangs in the mountains or leaders of the urban killer groups.
What did you do about these diaries? Were they published at all?
I don't know. I think they were. I don't know. I can't remember. I don't know. I think they were. Whether they were published in full or not, I don't know. Or whether a summary of them was published, I don't know. Ask John Ridaway.
Have you any thoughts on that, the publication? You know, did it rather negate the value of them? The fact that you had revealed...
I don't know. I wouldn't like to comment on it. I don't know.
Could I now ask you about a little more about the behaviour of the British troops in Cyprus? First of all, their efficiency. Were they built up during your time into a very effective force, do you think?
I like to think so, yes. They needed a good deal of training. And they needed a good deal of experience, especially of operations in the mountains. And the introduction of helicopters, of course, was a tremendous benefit for actual for movement, instead of having to trail along the roads in lorries and then on foot. They were brought to the scene of operations quickly and secretly by helicopter. But all that required training. They also required training in marksmanship. Their behavior, I think, was excellent. I think they showed great restraint under very severe provocations on occasions. I mean, there were, it's sad, there were occasions where they would have rough-handled a captor, having seen their comrades mutilated or buried or murdered. And, but on the whole, I think, and they always do. I've had experience of British troops operating in a security role, going back to India between the wars, and then in Italy, in Cyprus, in Trieste, and then in Malaya and in Kenya. Oh no, they're very, very reliable and good. They have to learn the tactics to deal with the particular enemy which they're fighting against. No, they sometimes make mistakes, of course, like everybody else. Everybody makes mistakes at times. The press and the media think that you're committing a crime if you make a mistake, which is stupid, really. But undoubtedly, of course, mistakes are made. And information doesn't get properly disseminated, doesn't get properly appreciated, and so on. But by and large, you can count on British troops being fair, being restrained, and being effective in anti-terrorist operations. Oh, and you've only got to listen to the odd Lance Corporal talking on the television about his responsibilities and activities in Northern Ireland now to realize what a very high standard they set for themselves and maintain.
What was their morale like in Cyprus?
Oh, very high. Oh, yes. No, I think this is due to the fact that they all knew why they were there, what they were being asked to do, and why it was necessary that they should do what they were asked to do. And this is something you've always got to make certain of. This is a command responsibility.
I'll put in you.